appreciate it.
Hi, everybody. My name is Daniel. I'm cross-addicted.
Hi, Daniel.
I got 5,403 days today, a day at a time and a step at a time, and I need to keep the emphasis on today. You know, what can I do for my program today? First and foremost, my sobriety date's February 17, 2003. It's good to be able to kind of look around the room and see some folks that I know. We brought some folks down here with us, but outside of that, I see folks that I know in the rooms from the meetings, and that's a real big deal. First of all, this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I'm an alcoholic. I say I'm cross-addicted because I got a problem with drugs and alcohol, but alcohol is my deal, you know, bottom line. And, you know, and the day thing, when I talk about the day thing, how many days I have today, because you get all kinds of different opinion on it. But for me, when I went into Snowden, from day one, they said, how many days do you have today? How do you feel emotionally? And how do you feel physically? And I had to do that, and I had to say that every day that I went into that meeting. And before I knew it, the days started to kind of move up, and before you know it, I had a few days under my belt, and it was working for me, and I continued to do that way. So thank you, Sam, for asking me to come here and speak today. It's always an honor. If somebody asks you to do something, you might ought to do it, because you're either going to help yourself or you can help somebody else without even knowing what you're doing, and it's a big deal. So I'm supposed to tell you what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm not going to go into any major drunkalogue, but I got to tell you a little bit about me in order for you to see where I was and how things went. You know, for me today, it's all about the recovery part of it and the service part and what we do to help ourselves and help other people in this program today. We all know how to get drunk. We've all done it. You know, we've all been in that position. So for me, it started, you know, early on. You know, in high school, I wasn't a big drinker in high school at all. I went to Spotsylvania County, Cortland High School. We were, you know, a football nation down there, football team. We played a lot of ball down there, and things were great. You know, ninth grade, I wasn't drinking a whole lot. I'd see guys drinking and doing what they were doing, and then I'd try it, and I wasn't a fan. I just wasn't a fan of it. You know, my sophomore year and junior year, things started to escalate a little bit better. You know, we were winning, playing football, and all we had to do was have our jersey on and go into one of these locations, and people would basically give us whatever we wanted. You know, we thought we were kings of the walk, that kind of deal. Senior year was good. We used to have these big parties out in the county, and everybody would come. My brother would put out flyers in the mall, and we think it'd be, you know, 150 people or so, and it ended up being 300-400 people. And, of course, the good alcoholics, the way we are, we say, hey, we ought to charge for these guys coming in here. And so that's what we do. We charged $10 a carload for everybody that was coming inside. And all they were doing was coming there to be around the bonfire and get drunk, you know, and that's what we did. You know, moving on from there, I went to college. I went to WVIT, West Virginia Institute of Technology. I went there on a football scholarship. Got there. Things were good. But then I was introduced to real drinking on the college scene, real drinking. And the next thing I know, these guys had these, it was like a funnel with a thing on the bottom of it, and they were filling it up with beer and seeing how fast you could drink it down, and that's what I did. And continued to do it. We had a sign on our door, it was called the Bus Boys, is on the door, but in order for you to get into this club that we had in college, you had to drink a 40 ounce of beer in 40 seconds or less. Of course, I could do that, you know, at that time. I could do it. And coming out of that, you know, I should have known early. They started calling me Deucey Deuce early because all I drank was those little 22-ounce Coors drinks, those little bottles. And most kids have food and stuff in the refrigerator. I had two shelves of 22 Coors Light, and that's what I drank. So hence the name Deucey Deuce. I'll get into some of these other crazy nicknames these folks have for me now in the Fredericksburg area and how they come about. But, you know, today I know that my past has taught me a lot. And so moving on from there, you know, coming out of college, you know, I got to tell this story, basically what ended up happening. I was doing okay that first year in school, and then the drinking really escalated, and I started doing really bad in school, you know, from that point. Around this exact same time, my mother's a diabetic, you know, and she ended up getting really sick. And they ended up, you know, doing some amputees and amputating on her and cutting on her foot, then half of her leg. And so it was between my brother and I. And the bottom line is I had to end up leaving school to go home to take care of my mom. And so when I get there, you know, I see her and she's in the shape that she's in. And I see all the things. And then, of course, I use that as an excuse to drink more and to do things more. You know, I was that guy that had to pick his mom up to put his mom in the bathroom and, you know, and help her do those type of things. She didn't want any part of that. She didn't want me doing that. She didn't want me to see it. You know, she had gotten to a point to where she needed a kidney. I wanted to give her one of mine to do that, and she refused. You know, and needless to say, she ended up paying the price for what that was. You know, I was drinking so much at this time I started using and got into the drug scene because I wanted this blank all of that out and still wanted everybody to think I was being of use. And that wasn't the case, you know. So the bottom line is I ended up leaving. My brother and my aunt ended up taking care of my mom, and I took off and tried a geographical change. I'd met this girl while being out in the street doing the things that I was doing, and she ended up getting pregnant. So I wanted to do the next right thing, and that's move and try to take care of her. The way this story came about was I used to hang in these areas where these people were drinking and doing the things that I was doing. And the bottom line is that I ended up meeting this girl, and we ended up hooking up. We were drinking together, doing the things that we do, and she ended up getting pregnant. So one day I was in the Bragg Hill or Mayfield area, and I stop at the 7-Eleven to go in there to get me a Deucey Deuce. And when I go to walk in the door, there's a picture on the side of the door. And as I was walking through the door, I looked at the picture, and I kept looking at the picture, and I went inside. And I was like, wow, that really looks like this girl I've got in my trunk. So I came back out, and I did the exact same thing with the beer in my hand. I looked at the picture again, and I got in the truck, and I said, Melissa, is that you? And she was like, yeah, that's me. So I got out of the truck and went back and looked, and needless to say, this girl was 17 at the time. And she was pregnant, and I'm the dad of this deal. So I do the next right thing, being the alcoholic and addict that I am. I get on the phone, and I call the number that's on there, and they end up transferring me to her mother. And the deal is that her mother ended up coming here. We ended up meeting each other, and I was going to do the next right thing. There weren't any consequences for me at that particular time for the deal, but we ended up having a beautiful daughter together, and it just didn't work because I was an alcoholic and I was an addict. You know, I wanted to do everything except for be exactly where I wanted to be at. So needless to say, when I get there, we get down and I move from here and we go all the way to Ashland, Kentucky is where they're from, the tri-state area, Ashland, Kentucky. So basically everything was happening here. You could go across the bridge this way, you'd be in Beckley, West Virginia. You could go across the bridge the other way, and you're in Ohio. And needless to say, that tri-state area was the big hub for all of that badness that was coming from those areas. And I was right at home. I was right at home. And I started back again as harder than I was before, and wasn't taking care of my responsibilities, not doing what I was supposed to do. So I made the next geographical change, and I came back home, came back here. So after I get back here, you know, things were, you know, we do that change. It's about 3 or 4 weeks into the deal, and I'm not drinking. I'm not using. I'm trying to do the next right thing. And I meet my wife that I have today. And we were at a place called Carlos O'Kelly's in Fredericksburg out there. And that's where we met at. And I kept, you know, I chased her around and chased her around and wanted her to go out with me. She'd never go out with me. We drank together. She smoked weed. I didn't do any of that, but I was okay with that, you know, but we drank together at the bar. And then finally, after about 2.5 months, I got tired of chasing around. So I said, you know what? I'm done. I said, I'm going to stop asking you out. I'm not going to do that anymore. And then she said, wow, you're just starting to make some progress. And so needless to say, you know, I'm an alcoholic and I'm an addict. Immediately, I'm like, whoa, now I'm getting somewhere. So we get together, you know, and then we have the opportunity together to open up this new store in Madison, Wisconsin. And it was a new Carlos O'Kelly's, brand new. So her and I go there. I'm the assistant manager of the location. She's the bar manager over top of the area. Things were great. You know, I had gotten a little sobriety under my belt. I had like 3 months, you know, a lot. I was feeling really good. And as we were moving, it was an 18-hour ride. We were in a U-Haul, pulling the car, everything we owned. We took up, I pulled her away from her kids, the whole deal, decisions that we make, and we drove all the way to Madison, Wisconsin. When we get to Madison, Wisconsin, I'm lost. I don't know where I'm at. So I pull through this neighborhood that looks similar to one of the neighborhoods I used to run frequent down here in this area, and immediately the seed was planted in my head. It was about a week and a half later, 2 weeks later, as soon as I got the opportunity to get out and do anything I could do, I was back in that neighborhood that looked like what it used to look like here. And before you know it, I was doing the same thing in the same places with different people again and again. And I ended up getting busted while I was there. And all the wrongdoings that I had done while I was in Ashton, Kentucky caught up with me. So when that caught up with me, they ended up extraditing me from Madison, Wisconsin, all the way back to Ashland, Kentucky, to do the time that I had to do. So needless to say, the lady that I had the child with, she's there in that particular area. And, you know, a good alcoholic, we're good at getting what we want when we want it. So immediately I get on the phone. She finds out I'm back there, and she starts bringing the kid up there to see me, you know, and she's there. So I need what I need. You know, you need money. You know, you need money when you're locked up. You need this. You need that. So we put on that facade, just like we do in this program. We put on that facade like everything's going to be great. Everything's going to be fine. You just keep coming up here to see me. Keep bringing my daughter up here and keep the money coming. That was me. That was my thought process. And I'm telling you how I am. By the grace of God, today I've learned a lot different today. So anyways, the time ends up. My time that I had to do there, it was right at 22 months, somewhere in that area. And it was time for me to be released. And I didn't want to stay in Ashton, Kentucky. So my then, before my being my wife, then I got released to her custody in Madison, Wisconsin. So I ended up going back to Madison. So needless to say, all the lies and stories I had told this girl made the resentment of a lifetime, another lifetime. So I ended up going back to Madison, Wisconsin, getting a job and doing exactly what I was supposed to do. Things were getting better because I'd written my wife, you know, while I was in that jail, at least 1,000 letters said, honey, I promise you I won't do it again. You know, baby, if you just give me one more chance, I'm going to get a job. I'm going to give you the money. I'm going to help you take care of the kids. And I told all those stories that I told. And when I got back and got released to Madison, Wisconsin, I did the exact same thing 2 weeks later after being gone all that amount of time, being away from her. We had to file bankruptcy the entire deal and ended up doing the exact same thing all over again, hurting her again. So the move came from there as we moved back to Virginia. So because that'll make everything better if we get back to Virginia. So when we get back to Virginia, we start building a house. We started it there in 99, actually. So one of my last bouts or last rounds was we built our house in 2000. So I had to drive from Madison, Wisconsin, all the way here. So when I left, I had her paycheck, I had my paycheck, and we had saved up some money. And I drove that 18 hours back here to set the stakes where our new home was going to be at. That's what I was going to do, set the stakes. And I set four stakes on the property. I went to see my brother for a minute. I saw my dad for a minute. And the remainder of that time, I was running the streets wide open until it was time to go back home. And here's the sad part. Alcoholic and addict, I didn't have money to get back home. And I came there with all that money. You know, so I know today that she's gone through a lot for me. So it took me another 2 years, even though the house was built, actually 3 years until the house was built. In 03, going into what happened, February 03, it was about 6:30 or so in the morning. I remember that. I was the type of alcoholic and addict that would go out, and I would say, hey, honey, I'm going to go out and get a pack of cigarettes. I'll be right back. I'll be right back. And sure enough, every time, as soon as I left the house, I'd be gone 2-3 days sometimes. You know? So this one particular time I came back on the day before, when I came back, I'd come down the road, down my little road where I lived at, and I'd cut the lights off about halfway down. And then when a car turned in the driveway, I turned the car off so it wouldn't make any noise and just kind of let my car coast in to the area. So the car would coast into the area, I'd stop, put it in park, and then I'd go in the side door because I didn't want anybody to hear me, and I'd lay down on the sofa and act like I'd been there the whole time. That's my thinking. So the kids would wake up in the morning, I'd hear them running down the steps, boom, boom, boom. They're like, oh, daddy's home, hey, daddy, you know. And that was all fun, and I'd pick my head up, hey, kid, you know, that type of deal. But then I'd hear that third set of footsteps coming down the steps. And when that third set of footsteps started coming down the steps, she would get to the bottom, she'd look over at the sofa at me, and she'd say, you son of a bitch, you did it again. Every time. And I had no feeling, no emotion about that, none whatsoever. She said, I'm done. She said, I am done. Literally, I'm done. And I was like, okay, whatever. I mean, she's told me that 1,000 times. She said, no, really, I'm done. She reached in her pocket, she pulled out her pocket, and she dropped out this piece of paper. And it was a lease to another apartment. And I'm like, what's that? She said, I've already moved all the stuff from upstairs. Me and the kids are gone. We're done. So I was like, what is she talking about? So I creep up the steps, and I look around the corner, and all the furniture's gone. Everything's gone. And it shows you how much we get up in our head because it's all about us. I would never even imagine, like, going up there to think that something like that had happened, that she was going to – because I told her so many times before, you know. So when she said that, immediately I said, maybe I got to do something about this. You know, maybe I might just have a problem. And especially with the furniture gone, because instead of me thinking the furniture's gone, I'm like, who the hell helped her move that? How did she get all that stuff out of there? You know, but I'm telling you, from the situations that we put our families through, because you're going to hear me talk about that, our families are the ones that we hurt the absolute most. You know, those are the ones that we make believe that the things that we're doing are okay. It's not going to happen again. If you just give me one more chance. You know, the only thing that I found for me that helps with that is time and time only. And I can tell you for the last 5,403 days, it's getting better. It's getting better. You know, by the grace of God, I'll have 15 years a day at a time if I make it to February 17th. But I can tell you all it takes for me is this. Hey, babe, I'm going to go to the store. I'll be right back. And be gone longer than I say I'm going to be gone, and immediately a flag goes up. Her thought process, because we trained her, I trained her so well over the years to think that the shit that I was doing was acceptable. You know, my family, my dad, you know, my mom when she was living, you know, the whole scenario, you know. So after that, I said, you know what, I'm going to check myself into Snowden, and I'm going to go down here. So I went to Snowden in Fredericksburg, and I remember going in there, into Snowden that day. And I walked in, and immediately I sit down at the table, and they do this consultation with you, and they have you answer these questions. So I tried to fake my way around those questions and say what I had to say. And before I knew it, it was 28 days I had to be there before I knew it, because I thought I was telling what they wanted to hear, and that's not the case. And that's probably the deal that saved my life, to be absolutely honest, because after that time, I went into it's called an IOP program, an intensive outpatient program, and it was every Tuesday, every Thursday. You know, we had to be there at this particular time, and we were supposed to go to meetings in between. So I started doing that, started going to meetings. And then after about 90 days of clean sobriety in that time, I was sitting in a classroom, and I remember all the AA people, there was 26 of us there. And I remember Elaine, her name was Elaine Westcoat, she doesn't mind me to say her name. Elaine said, hey, Daniel, she said, how many meetings are you going to a week? I said, oh, Elaine, I'm going to the Monday night meeting. I'm going to Misfits on Tuesday. I'm going to Wednesday over the hump, the Friday night speaker meeting. My home group's on Thursday, by the way. I do one on Saturday. I'm doing two on Sunday. So she looks at the entire class, 26 people, said, how many of you guys have seen Daniel at any of those meetings he's talking about? And the entire class was like, nope. Busted again. I'm busted again. So during the class, she said, hey, Daniel, she said, I'm going to see you after the class. I said, okay, yes, ma'am. And so all the other folks leave, and I walk in to her office. She said, here's the deal. She said, if you don't start going to AA meetings, she said, and doing what you're expected to do of in this program, I'm going to call your insurance company. I'm going to let them know that you're not following protocol, and you're going to have to pay every dime of that money back. And immediately, all of a sudden, going to an AA meeting and putting a dollar in the basket, made a lot of sense. Whole lot of sense. Matter of fact, I put two in the basket every time now. Because, you know, That's a minimal cost for what it would cost me to be able to go out and hurt family and stuff the way that I did. So after that, I started going to AA meetings. They started seeing me. And something really miraculous started to happen. I started to get to know people. I started to get to see some of the same faces. Like I talk about this deal with deja vu. You see the same people in the same places doing the same things, you know. And I started to pick up service work. Service work, you know. That was a big deal right there for me. You know, my first service position, and I'm jumping around a little bit, but my first service position was taking out the trash at the chancellor meeting. This guy named Brad came up to me and he said, "Hey, buddy," he says, "I think you can get a key to this building right now." And I said, "Holy snap, do you know you're giving me a key to this building? Really? Do you know what I could do with that?" You know? And so I became Dan the Trash Man for about the next 6 years. I got a hat that says it. It says they gave it to me at an anniversary. It says Dan the Trash Man. So that's one of those nicknames we'll talk about as we move forward. So with that being said, after I got busted again from Elaine, I started going to meetings. And I remember going to a meeting. It was a 12 o'clock noon meeting on 60 Butler Road. Every day at noon, there was a meeting. And I'd go into that meeting, and all these old-timers would be there, man. I could see these guys, you know, around there. But my first time pulling up, I was in this little blue Isuzu pickup truck, and I was smoking a cigarette in the truck. And in the front of the building was all these bikers. And all these chaps had black chaps on and a shirt and the jacket, and they were sitting around on these picnic tables and like blocking the door. And I was like, "Man, there's no way I'm going up in there. I don't see no black people here." So I finally mustered up the courage. I put the cigarette down and I finally walked through the door and started walking toward that fence. And there was a post here, post here, and picnic tables in the back. And as I got to the middle of that gate, this guy named DC with black chaps and a jersey on walked up and reached out his hand and he said, "Welcome. We're glad to have you." Immediately, all that apprehension that I had up here, all that thought process, just dropped right off, man. And then the next amazing thing happened to me. When I walked in the building, everybody was laughing and giggling and having great times and doing all this. And I said, "There's no way these people are this happy." Because I wasn't feeling like they were putting out. You see what I mean? They were putting out this happiness, and I just wasn't feeling that. So then as soon as I get in there, I sit down, and they start talking about the meeting. I started hearing people say things exactly like that happened to me. And my first, being an alcoholic and addict, my thought process was, how did Elaine Westcoat get down here and tell these people my story before I got in here? So I let that one go. So then the next day I go to another meeting, and I start hearing some of the exact same people saying the same stuff that happened to me again. And I said, "There's no way she can get around to these meetings and talk to these people." So it started to get me involved into what was going on. It got me to start paying attention. And I heard my story from this lady, and Cliff R. was my sponsor at the time, but I heard my story through this lady, and I said, "There's no way that this lady did the exact same things that I did. There's no way." So sure enough, man, we ended up talking. Cliff R. ends up being my sponsor at the time, and he was that type of guy, and we all have him in all of our districts, that reach their hand out to those young folks like we do, but they take on a lot of sponsees. You know, they got a lot of sponsees, and he had like 12 at the time. You know, I was like, "Dude, when do you have time for yourself to do anything?" You know, he said, "These guys are keeping me sober." And that was one of those first realizing things for me that works, you know, reaching your hand out to somebody. So, you know, about this time, while I'm still going to meetings and I'm still at the IOP program, I remember around a few days, about 120 days or something, I remember sitting in a chair, something similar to that, and I was at my house, and I was going crazy. I wanted to use, I wanted to drink, I wanted to get high, and I was grabbing I was sitting in a chair, and I'm telling you, I was bending the chair, and finally I said, "They said to call somebody." So I called Cliff, and when I called Cliff, he wasn't at home. His wife answered the phone, or his girlfriend at the time. So when his girlfriend answered the phone, she said, "So what are you doing?" I said, I need to talk to Cliff. I want to drink. I'm ready to get out of here. I'm ready to jump out of my skin." She said, "Do you have a box of toothpicks?" I was like, "Yeah, a box of toothpicks. Yeah, why?" She said, "I want you to throw them on the counter, count them, and put them back in the box, and then call me back." So immediately I'm like, "What the hell is she talking about?" So I do what she says. I count the toothpicks. You know, I'm counting them. I'm putting them back in the box. And I call her back, and I said, So I counted the toothpicks. There's 232 toothpicks, and I put them back in the box. And she hung up the phone. Click. Holy snap. What's that all about? So I called her back, and she said, how do you feel now? And I got what she was talking about. This moment too shall pass, because that thought process that I had, wanting to go out, use, and do the things that I wanted to do, was gone. Now, to this day, I don't know if that box of toothpicks saved my life, but I give it credit for the box of toothpicks. Matter of fact, I got two of them in my pocket now. So, you know, but, you know, so moving forward from there, guys, you know, they told me to get a sponsor, which I had. They told me to get a home group, and they told me to go to meetings. Those were the essential three things that I needed to get sober, you know, along with what's on that coin. You know, when it talks about recovery, unity, and service on that deal. And that's what I did. I had to become a service and become a part of this deal. And I started to feel really comfortable inside the rooms, you know, going to meetings and doing what I was supposed to do and becoming a part. My first other real service position as far as the district goes was a GSR. And I remember being at my Thursday night meeting, and I remember going to the bathroom, and when I came back and they pointed at me, Mike Fleming said, you're the new GSR for this group. And I was like, what do you mean? What is that? What does that mean? You know, what do I do? And they said, all you got to do is just show up. It'll teach itself. And it does. And that was probably one of the better things that happened to me, you know, becoming a GSR. You know, Cliff had taken us to about 13 years ago, we went to the Wally P. Back to Basics 12-step program. I don't know if any of you guys have heard of it, but you do all 12 steps in a month. But we did all 12 in a day because Wally P., the guy who wrote the book, was there. And it was awesome. You know, we went through the entire process, step one, step two, step three, and we got to step four. You know, and then when we got to step four, he said, this is what I want you guys to do. He said, you got everything written down. I want you to look around the room. I want you to pick out a person. And you guys are going to go sit down somewhere quiet, and you're going to do your fifth step. I'm like, okay, cool. I'll never see this dude again or whatever the deal is. So I pick the guy, and then we go down here underneath this oak tree, and he tells me all of his stuff, you know. And I tell him all of my stuff, you know. And I'm thinking, well, his stuff's not anywhere near as bad as my stuff. But I said, it's okay. I won't see him no more anyways. So after I get in the district, I go to my first area meeting, and it's in Tanglewood. And when I go to Tanglewood, we get up there, and all the new GSRs have to stand up, and you have to go up there and tell a little bit about yourself, who you are, what you do, where you're from, and what you're how you're being of service. And I look back behind me, and short and shit, there's the guy, right back behind me. And I knew the back of my neck was heating up for some reason, but I didn't know why. But when I look back, he was right there. So it's kind of like the feeling it gives me is what it gives me today. When you've got something going on in your life, and something that you need to talk about, when you go to a meeting, the topic is exactly that. You know, does that happen by mistake? I don't know if it happens by mistake or not, but I just know when it does happen, I'm like, this is exactly where I need to be at. And it happens a lot. You know, it definitely happens a lot. Now, this time of year, you know, it's Christmas and going into Thanksgiving. There's a whole lot of gratitude going on. There's a whole lot of gratitude meetings going on. And I hear people talk about that all the time. You know, I'm grateful today, you know. I wasn't all that grateful when I first got here because I didn't want to be even called an alcoholic or even called an addict for that matter. I didn't want any part of that, you know. So in the beginning, I wasn't grateful, but I grew to be grateful by the steps of this program. You know, the steps 1 through 12, man, are huge. You know, I've worked the steps with a bunch of guys. I hold a step study, a 20-week step study group at my home. You know, we get 15, 16 guys come in there. And we talk about the first 164 pages of this book, how it's helped us, where it's at. My sponsor right here, he tells me, if there's a problem, the answer is in the book. It's in the book. And if I don't know where it's at, he'll point at it. He'll say, well, let's go right here. Let's look at it. You know, so I can learn from those things. I try to remember what they tell me. I don't know every page of the big book, but those important pages to me, they really jump out at me. And there's a lot of important stuff in there. On page 417, it talks about acceptance, you know, and it tells me about acceptance. It tells me about me. It tells me when there's something going on, you know, it's not so much of what's going on in the world, it's what's going on with me is what it tells me. It also tells me, Rick taught me this. He said on the bottom of page 100, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics aren't supposed to do, you know, at the bottom of that page, assuming that we're spiritually fit when we get ready to do what we have to do. You know, so that's a real big part. You know, in the beginning, I didn't think I could go to football games because I drank there. You know, I didn't think I could do those events that people do because I drank there. It took me 18 months to eat a crab, for God's sake, because I thought crabs and beer were absolutely delicious together because what I did. But you know what? A Diet Pepsi is just as good today for me. It's just as good. And I eat just as many crabs, if not more, because I don't fill up as quick. So, you know, life's good today. You know, my service work, you know, I think I've talked about what it used to be like, what happened, why I got to where I was at, and what it's like now. You know, today for me, looking at that clock, it's, 25 till. Today for me, it's about doing, you know, doing the next right thing. Even if I don't know it, I'm going to ask somebody and I'm going to find out about it, what the next right thing is. You know, I try to make myself available when opportunities come, you know, for other people, you know, for myself, you know, at the same time. So, because the only way I can stay sober is to give away what's been so freely given to me. So my next venture in the service was I was a chairperson for the jails in the Fredericksburg area, District 30. And when we started off that group, and I do say we, there was about three of us that started. Today there's about 14 or 15 of us, but not just one meeting, but four meetings that go into the jail on a regular basis. The great thing is I've had some great experiences while I'm in jail. You know, the amazing thing is because I see myself a lot when these folks go in and they come back out. The longer we're in there, you'll see a guy come in and he's got it. When I get out, I'm going to meetings. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do this. And 3 months later, you see him right back in the same block. You know, the exact same block. That's Einstein's definition of insanity. We do the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. You know, insane is, to me, we know what we're getting ready to do is wrong. We know it's not right. We know the consequences it's going to bring to us. And we do it anyway. We do it anyway, knowing what the end result is. You know? So they tell me today I have to think the drink all the way through. You know? So when those situations arise and they come up, I've got to think it all the way through. You know, those meetings, there's a couple different sad scenarios, and there's been also great things that have happened. The diversion center is not too far from that on Eskimo Hill Road. It's more set up like a prison when you go in. The jail, when you go into the jail, once you walk into the jail, you get there, you sit down, they let the guys come out to the block, come out of the block, and we have an AA meeting. We do it the exact same way we do it here. We read the preamble, how it works, the traditions. We also read more about alcoholism, because more about alcoholism tells me exactly about me. All the things that I tried to do, you know, the ways that I tried to stop drinking, the people that I stopped trying to hang around, you know, and all those things, it tells me. It tells me exactly me. So after we read more about alcoholism, we read the promises, you know, to those guys. And then we open the meeting up. So when they get out, if they get out, they'll know that they can come out of somewhere, but they got to make the effort from there because you have to be willing to change. You know, you have to change your whole thought process, the whole perspective. You know, I was told a while back that change, the acronym for change, is choosing honesty allows new growth every day. Because I'm a liar by trade. I'm a liar by trade. You know, it's what we do. You know, because we want to simplify everything. You know, these guys right here that came with us today, they say they came here to make sure I stay honest, that I keep it honest. Well, what they don't know is what Rick tells me, what George tells me, is he said, if you just tell the truth the first time, you don't have to try to remember any lies. You know, and the only thing that I see different about a story when I tell a story versus 10 years ago and now is I talk about the growth of where I've grown at. You know, we talk about the programmer, the experiences that we share today, you know, and what we do. You know, so it's definitely a great way of life for me today. Those jail experiences, man, are really good. There was a group of four or five of us that used to come out every time. And when we first walk into the jail, you walk in, that door slams shut. Boom. You know, when I walked in, that smell that I remember so well was right there. It was right there, the exact same smell. Bad smell, like bad food, bad feet, the entire deal. And in between the cell blocks and where they go, all four of us would be walking out after the meeting. That one door would shut and the other door would close in front of it. And while we were waiting for the door to open, us four were sitting there, and every time for almost 7 or 8 years, without fail, those guys would say, "Man, that was a great meeting." You know? So it's not necessarily always what can we bring to it? You know, what can we bring to the meeting and what can we take from it, you know, today? So I try to listen to people today because I can learn stuff with young folks that are with 24 hours to 28 hours coming in. I heard one of the most profound things at Eskimo Hill Road. A guy had 28 hours of sobriety. He had just got there. He's still shaking. And we're sitting in the AA meeting, and we asked him his name. He said his name, and I said, you want to share a little bit about your story? He said, you know what? He said, I'm an alcoholic, man. He said, my problem is, he said, I love to drink. And when I drink, I get so stupid that I do stupid stuff, and I have to pay the consequences no matter what. And then he said, if there was a bottle of alcohol sitting in the floor, right there in the floor, he said, that bottle can do absolutely nothing to me. He said, it can do nothing to me but sit right there. And then he said, what happens is he said, I pick it up, I put it in me, and I bring it to life. And that was big from a dude with 28 hours. Because it's true. When you put it in you, and then he said, if you don't put it in you, you can't get it in you. I do that 28 hours. You know what I'm saying? So that's a big deal. You know, we try to carry our experience, strength, and hope when we talk to these folks. And another one of my great stories from the Eskimo Hill Road was there was a guy. He came in there because it's a six-month program. You're only there for 6 months. So when you're there, they try to acclimate you back into the world, back out into the job force, and get you back rolling. So he had about 2 weeks left, and he came to me before the meeting. Well, after the meeting was done, he said, Daniel, he said, you know what? He said, I got to tell you, man, I'm scared to death to leave out of here because I know what's going to happen. He said those words, I know my track record. I said, look, man, when you get out of here, you got a couple of options. You can pick the phone up, you can call me, I can get you to a bus, and we can get you back down there. But most importantly is when you get back to that Virginia Beach, Chesapeake area, you need to go directly to a meeting. You need to raise your hand and say, hey, I'm brand new. I need to get help. Because you guys know what we do when you raise your hand and somebody tells you they need help. And I said, those people will flock around you. They will grab a when and where. They will sign their name, write their name, and have you to call them. And you need to pick up the phone and you need to call is what you need to do. You know, 2 years ago, this same guy, after about 7.5 years later, he called me up and he said, hey, Daniel, this is Jack. I just wanted you to know I'm getting ready to go into Christmas again and I'm still sober. So that's a blessing, man. That's a blessing. I didn't get him sober. You know, all we can do, like they talk about, is just carry the message. That's all we can do is just carry the message because you can't make anybody stay sober. They couldn't do it for me. You know, they talked to me, blue in the face, Daniel. You know, why don't you just please just stop drinking? You got a problem. You know, I'm okay. That was my famous word. I'm okay. I'll be just fine. I'll be just fine. You guys know what that means, too. You know, so I have to remember today for me, in order to stay right today, I need to stay right in the middle of this thing right here, of this program. I need to stay in the middle of meetings. You know, they tell me to stay sober, and that's why I say what I say with my days. What can I do for my program today? Well, some of the things that I do today is I try to talk to at least 3 alcoholics a day. And I'll keep calling on the phone until I talk to at least 3 alcoholics. I might end up calling 6 or 7 people. But at the end of the day, after I talk to those 3, when things start getting rough or something starts happening that's not going my way or I'm kicking and screaming out in the shop or my employees aren't acting right, immediately the phone will ring or a text message will come through and say, how you doing? And it's at the exact right time, every time. And again, just like going into a meeting with the topic, that's no coincidence. You know, for me today, it's no coincidence. So, you know, I just need to remember that service work keeps me. I'll tell you guys a story about Miss B. Miss B was in the Fredericksburg area for years. She would have 40 years now, George. She'd have 40 years now, and she ended up passing and dying on us, but she died sober. But she was a little old lady, man. At the time, she was 70, 75, 76, and I used to pick her up, and I used to take her to meetings, and we used to go to these meetings. We used to go out to Lake of the Woods, and everybody knew who Miss B was, everybody, you know. And she would say this little thing at the end. She said, I love each and every one. I love each and every one of you, whether you like it or not, and that's it. You know, that's what she'd say. But I've taken her meetings, and I remember one time I took her, we went to the Brooks Park meeting. We used to go out there to Brooks Park, and she loved ice cream. She loved ice cream. So we were coming back into town out of Brooks Park, and she said, Daniel, I sure would like to get some of that Coles ice cream. And I said, okay, Miss B, ain't no problem. So we pull up the Carl's Ice Cream on the curb, and it's right there on Princess Anne Street. So I go around, I open the door for her, and she gets out. I help her out of the car. And as she's getting out of the car, I grab her hand, and we're holding hands, and we're walking up here to get ice cream. And all of a sudden, I hear a horn blowing. Hut, hut, hut. Daniel, what are you doing holding that old woman's hand? And I'm like, holy snap. I said, this is my friend. You know, and immediately, even in sobriety, we think we have to explain ourselves out, explain ourselves away. But she was one of my, she was a really good friend of mine. She really touched a lot of people in this room. You know, one of the small miracles that we have, and here, sitting here too, over there with that Redskins hat on over there, his name's William. Miss B used to, well, he goes by Willie, Chainsaw Willie. And don't ask me why, we'll talk about that later. And but he used to, Miss B was one of those ladies who would always try to get William sober. Always. She would come in the room and she said, I want y'all to pray for Willie. He's been trying to get sober. He said, we've been working together since 1992. I want y'all to pray for Willie. He's going to make it. And Willie did what we all do. You know what I mean? He don't mind me talking about him because we work together. You know, the deal is that we go out, we come back in, and we welcome you. We welcome everybody back in. You go out, we come back, you welcome them back in. You know, when they, you go out, you come back, you welcome them back in. At some point, they go out, you come back, and they're like, here we go again. Here we go again. On this last round, that's where I was. That's where I was with William because we've been friends since high school, coming all the way up through from 84 all the way through. And I said, here we go again. But he surprised me this time. He surprised me this time. 6.5 years later, he's doing his thing over there. So Miss B's prayer definitely came true. Years after years after years of saying the exact same thing over and over again to get a great end result. You know, life's good today. You know, I can't wait to, by the grace of God, Sam has worked with us to get us into this jail down here. It's pretty cool. You know, it's a different service position for me. It's an hour from my house. You know, it's an hour for me to get to Fredericksburg down here. But I did that for a reason, you know, because I know that there's going to be a meeting there because all we have to do is show up. But it gives me that time from point A to point B to reflect and think about what I've got going on for that day. You know, I own my own business now. I didn't have that before, you know, not whatsoever. I was living paycheck to paycheck. I was living my wife's paycheck to paycheck. And we own a business now that we've got people that work for us that we have to, you know, not necessarily treat with kid gloves, but treat them the way that we want to be treated. It didn't work for me that like that in the beginning. I was that, you need to do this, you need to do that, you need to do this. And then Rick told me, he said, you know, you might want to take a look at that. You know, being treated the way you want to be treated. And you know what? It's amazing how that works instead of jacking somebody or hollering at somebody in front of 9 other people, then pulling them aside. Hey, say, you got a minute? Hey, can we talk for a second? Man, I get better results out of that than anything in the world. And it's only because of this program that happens for me today. You know, so I'm definitely glad to be here. You know, I'm definitely willing to learn. I have to remain teachable. I'll tell this and then I'll get ready to close. There was a speaker, his name was Mr. Corky. And I remember Mr. Corky being 2 weeks shy of 25 years sobriety. And I remember him speaking at the old, not Union Hall, but it was the old, not the skating rink there, but it was the old building down there in off Carolina, off Lafayette Boulevard, Levels Road. But it was a big, long hall like this. And I remember when you came in, there was chairs all the way on this side. Chairs on this side, and there was a podium set up here just like this. But it was 150, 200 people in there, man. And when he spoke, I just listened. And I remember standing way back by the door because I didn't want anybody to see me, and I was just like listening to what he was saying, but it was making a lot of sense. And he said that one thing. He said, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I said, what the heck? What does he mean by that? What is he talking about? So after the meeting was done, I went up to him and I said, Mr. Corky, what do you mean by that? He says, well, Daniel, and the amazing thing was he knew my name. He says, well, Daniel, and I thought nobody knew it because I was hiding. He said, when somebody asks you, you know, to do something, you might ought to do it, you know, because that right person is going to step into your life at the exact right time. And all you have to be willing to do is listen and pay attention, you know. And then that's when we went into the whole prayer and meditation thing because I didn't know there was a difference. between prayer and meditation and working with these steps and doing the things that we do. You know, I used to pray for things all the time, but I didn't pray for the right things. You know, I was the guy that was driving around the mall parking lot and said, God, please help me find a parking spot. Please. And I'd see one, and I'd be the dude be like, never mind, I got it. That was me. You know, sad to say, that was me. Because I thought I was doing that on my own. It just happened to pop up that way. You know, the foxhole prayers, all the things we do. And then somebody told me, they said, you know, if things are happening in your life or somebody does something bad to you, to pray for that person. What are you talking about? I'm not going to pray for that fool. I can't do that. I can't do it. And I finally ended up doing it because I took a suggestion and things got better. You know, things got better because it got me out of here. You know, because that's my worst enemy right there. When I get up inside that head right there, boy, I can do some damage. Quick, fast, and in a hurry, I can do some damage. Because I'm automatically going to think that I'm the boss, that I've got this. You know, when I know that God, my higher power, has me today. You know, so I just need to remember, for me, I need to stay honest about what we do, that how part of this program, you know, that honesty, open-mindedness, and the willingness. I didn't have that willingness all the time, but I try to have that honesty today. You know, I can sleep well at night today. You know, I can't do anything that's way off kilter without feeling the consequence of this program coming back at me. You know, we talk about holding doors open for people. I talk about it all the time. You know, I go into Wawa or one of those places, and you see somebody come, you grab the door, you hold the door open for them, and don't expect them to say thank you. You know, because not everybody's going to say thank you. I can tell when I'm having a great spiritual day when things are good because I don't worry about that. But some of those days when they walk through, I'm like, damn, didn't you see me holding the door for you? Because I want that. You know, I want them to recognize what I'm doing for them and what we're supposed to do without anything in return, you know. These guys tell me to do little things like buy a cup of coffee for somebody standing in the line and don't let them know you're buying it. Just walk out, you know, buy the coffee and keep on moving, you know. So my experience with that was I saw somebody from the program and I should have never bought their coffee because I knew they were going to catch me. I ended up buying the coffee, and at the next meeting they were like, hey, thanks for the coffee, by the way, Daniel. It didn't work that way. You know, you're supposed to do something for somebody else and not expect anything in return. But, you know, I'm glad to be out here. It's the first time I've been out here to this meeting. It's some great people out here, great faces out here, and I'm glad to be here. Thanks for letting me share, guys.